SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
Scholar and lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Going back to my Stanford undergraduate, we would learn that the real economy and financial markets were mirror images of each other.
Former Federal Reserve System governor.
I became governor of the Federal Reserve, and we had about seven or eight glorious months before the financial crisis hit us.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, Kevin Warsh. Now here's your host, Howard Wolf.
When the COVID-19 crisis first hit, the focus was almost entirely on the virus, its infectiousness, and its highly deadly medical impact. That made sense, as this was, as the name confirms, a novel coronavirus and not something we had ever experienced before from a public health standpoint. Although this focus on the virus itself clearly continues, a new focus has emerged of late. I speak of a focus on the deadly impact COVID-19 is having on our national and global economies, as governments around the world respond to the pandemic with highly restrictive measures. Due to the shelter-in-place orders, quarantines, and more, economies across the globe have experienced a freefall of massive proportions. U.S. unemployment numbers are beyond staggering, rivaled only by those experienced in the Great Depression. Today's guest on Stanford Pathfinders, Kevin Warsh, is, I hope, going to help us make sense of the effect of COVID-19 on our economy and what we should expect going forward. Kevin Warsh is a academic, financier, and former government official. Perhaps most importantly for today's topic, Warsh was a governor of the U.S. Federal Reserve System during and in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. He also acted as the central bank's primary liaison to Wall Street and served as the Federal Reserve's representative to the G20. Prior to his time at the Federal Reserve, Warsh served as special assistant to the president for economic policy and executive secretary of the White House National Economic Council. In other words, Kevin Warsh has the chops to talk economics. He is a proud 1992 grad of Stanford, who went to the Stanford of the East, otherwise known as Harvard, for law school. Finally, he is also the Shepherd Family Distinguished Visiting Fellow in Economics at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, as well as a scholar and lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Howard, thanks very much for having me.
So listen, I know we're here to talk about the impact that COVID-19 is having on our economy, but I've got to start with your Stanford story. Here you are, a kid from upstate New York. How'd you end up at Stanford? What was your experience? Who influenced you at Stanford? Where'd you hang out? Give us the background here.
Well, Stanford was my good fortune, as it's been the good fortune to you and so many other people that have gone before and since. I grew up in upstate New York, not far from Albany, and went to a great public school. And I remember showing up to see my guidance counselor. And my guidance counselor asked me, as he asked all the graduating students from my high school, there were about 600 in a class, do you plan on joining the workforce, going to two-year college or four-year college? And I said with some confidence, I hope to go to four-year college. He then said, okay, I have to fill out this New York State Regents form. Where would you like to go? And Stanford was the best school I knew in California. And so I said, I'd like to go to Stanford University in California. And he said, no, Stanford's in Connecticut. So in spite of the words from my guidance counselor, I ended up happily out there and bought two big Navy duffel bags on a blue super shuttle on orientation day in September, now almost 30 years ago, and changed my life.
Fantastic. So let's talk about COVID-19 and its impact on the economy. How bad is it? Help us get our head around the severity of the crisis from an economic standpoint. And the question everyone's asking is, how does this compare to what we experienced in the Great Depression? Very easy question for you to start off with, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for the softball, Howard. I would say my full disclosure, my scarring influence was the financial crisis of 2008 or 9. So that is of the crises that have been around. That's the one I lived for my time in government. And so that's the historical framework.
And help our listeners understand what your role was back in 2008 during the financial crisis.
So I was slogging away. So back in 08 and 09, after some time in New York on Wall Street, I found my way into government in 2002, working for President Bush. Chairman Bernanke, Ben Bernanke, was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House. I was a mid-level staffer at the National Economic Council, and the two of us hit it off. We worked on all sorts of projects together. And when it came time for the president to choose a new chairman at the Federal Reserve, much to my surprise, I think to Ben Bernanke's surprise, he chose Ben to fill the great shoes, the big shoes of Alan Greenspan at the time. And he chose Ben Bernanke, and I was fortunate enough that Ben Bernanke said, "Hey, if I go over there, will you come over with me and take my old job as a governor?" So he became a chairman of the Federal Reserve. I became governor of the Federal Reserve. And we had about seven or eight glorious months before the financial crisis hit us.
All right, so you've got that background, and now you're looking at today. How do you compare this to that? How do you compare this to the Great Depression? Where are we?
Yeah, so I'd say we're not in a great place. They call economics the dismal science for a reason. I would say the easiest way to compare this to those two economic shocks is to say, yeah, this was a shock as well. This pandemic effectively came out of nowhere. There were forewarnings of it. And heck, I remember being a mid-level staffer in the White House, and there were a series of quarterly pandemic meetings. So it's not like this idea was outside the realm of public policy and preparation. But it certainly hit the U.S. and the global economy at a most inopportune time. Global trade had been trending down really now for most of the last year and a half. Many of the U.S.'s big trading partners in the world, I would say, were on the front edges of recessions and weak economic growth. So if you could choose when a pandemic hits, you wouldn't choose this moment. If you asked me to compare this to the great financial crisis of about a decade ago and the Great Depression, I'd make a couple of distinctions. The 08-09 crisis really hit Wall Street first, hit big financial institutions first, hit listed securities first, and then obviously it had a real effect on the real economy. We ended up in a recession. This one, in contrast, really hits Main Street first. This hits storefronts in every town that you and I grew up in and that a lot of the listeners are living and driving through as they're hearing this broadcast. So this hits them first. They see it in store closures. They feel it in changes of behavior and in expectations. And they're certainly seeing it in massive unemployment. This one then can find its way onto Wall Street, find its way into banks. But this is a Main Street crisis. And again, if I were to compare then these two crises to the crisis from our history books, it's different because the Great Depression, you know, building on the work of Milton Friedman, who I was lucky enough to know 30 years ago when I was an undergraduate and who's written some of the most important work on the Great Depression became great because of public policy errors. That doesn't mean there wasn't underlying economic weakness, that there weren't vulnerabilities. But the bad public policy, importantly by the central bank or in and around the Great Depression, took what would have been a garden variety recession and made it historic. So that's a scarring experience for all of us in economics, which is public policy can make economies better and worse when they get hit by shocks. And that's why the focus today is so much on what Washington's doing in response to the events of the last 100 days.
So let's talk a little bit about unemployment because you mentioned it just moments ago. So depending on who you listen to, we're close to 15%, on the way some fear to 20% unemployment in this country, something unheard of since, well, the Great Depression. So what's the impact of that kind of unemployment on the economy? I mean, the nature of this is just uncharted for all of us in our lifetime.
It is, and I'd say it's a shock. And the 14.7% unemployment rate, which was reported just about a week ago, almost assuredly understates the effective unemployment rate.
What's the difference between that number and what you just said?
Yeah, well, the 14.7% is the official statistic, so we can begin with the official statistic. But I would say that understates for a few reasons. One, because there was such a surge to the unemployment insurance lines in the 50 states, it appears as though many of the people that are applying for unemployment didn't make it in by the time the survey was done. Surveys come from a couple of sources, but the unemployment insurance statistics are probably lagging. Secondly, what I'd say is we also saw another 2 or 3 percentage points of the working age population drop out of the labor force, sort of give up. And so that's another sign of underestimation. If you said to me, as we speak today, what's the effective unemployment rate, trying to take all those things into account, it's around 20%, which is unheard of. So just to put that in concrete terms, something like 1 out of 5 American workers lost their jobs, maybe 1 out of 6, depending on where we are. And we haven't reached the bottom of this in terms of the labor markets. So this is a huge shock to the U.S. And because the pandemic is global in nature, it's not as though the rest of the world is going swimmingly and we can count on them to be buying our products and services and to be helping. The global economy is being hit by this. So this is very serious stuff. And the reason why folks like me have devoted so much of my time to the conduct of public policy and why we do so much thinking about that at Stanford is you make the right kind of policy choices at a time like this and you can really improve things. You make the wrong choices and you end up in a much worse place.
So let's talk about improving things. I'm an optimist, so I'm already thinking about the recovery. And as I read about the recovery, I hear about two letters that are being bandied about to describe the recovery. Some people think we'll have a V recovery. Other people think we'll have a U recovery. Help us understand the difference between a V and a U. I mean, we know what the letters mean. We know how they sound them out. But what does it mean in terms of recovery? And which do you think we will experience?
Yeah, so I'd say because of the nature of the shock, we should be pretty humble about choosing which letter best captures the turn in this economy. I remember being about 19 years old, Howard, and stumbling into the Hoover Institution and Milton Friedman, probably the greatest, most consequential economist of the 20th century, was there, and I was doing a bit of work for him and John Kogan at the time, who's still a Hoover fellow and friend and colleague. And I asked Milton some question about some paper he was working on and some little data set I was working on. And he said, Kevin, there's one thing you really need to know about economics. So I, you know, probably took out my trapper keeper and started to write the ballpoint pen, this wisdom I was going to get from this Nobel Prize winner. And he said, Kevin, the only thing we know in economics, we teach in Econ 1. Everything else is made up. And so that humility from that man stood with me. And I will say when I was in government in 2008 and 9, and I looked around at some of the finest professionals in the world, 1,000 or so economists, all very well trained at the Federal Reserve, myself among them, trying to figure out what was going on, and I realized that Milton was right. They can give you a Nobel Prize for all sorts of good work, but economics isn't physics. So
is this your way of telling us you don't know whether it's going to be a V or a U?
Yeah, it's my way of saying none of us know, but I'll give you my judgment, okay. Which is if you make me choose a letter in the alphabet, a V suggests a rather sharp rather sharp pickup in the economy, something I don't see. The believers of the V tend to think that, well, we have this huge hole that was created by the pandemic. Consumers aren't buying, businesses aren't investing. So the government's going to spend a lot of money, add a lot of zeros, and fill in that hole. And they'll fill in the hole, and all of a sudden we'll be back to the old growth rate. I just don't believe it. That's not my view of how the economy works. The economy is a very complicated organism. It works in ways that are somewhat mysterious to economic models. And the idea of a quick bounce back here, I think, doesn't properly take into account the harm that's being done when we separate employers from employees, when we add uncertainty to behaviors. Various governors and the president can all tell us it's fine to go back to work, but there's scarring in the last 100 days, even if this thing were over in the next several weeks, which I think is unlikely. So if you force me to pick a letter, I'd pick a W. And that means things might well bounce from the bottom, from the first leg of the W, but there's a lot of learning and doing and reallocations of workers and capital, the new industries that need to take place. And the reason why, again, I'll choose the W is, like you, I'm an optimist. I think that there's no reason why the 21st century can't be America's century, but it's not without risks. And we've got to make the right public policy choices so that we come out of it growing just as fast or faster than we came into it. And so there's uncertainties about the shape of each of those legs of the W.
But if I'm understanding you correctly, a W means that we come back and then we drop again and then we come back again.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what it means.
All right, so let's talk about the stock market. I'm confused, right? So I'm watching the stock market. It dropped precipitously when this all broke. And over the past 30 days, it's been on a tear. It's been on a roar. And so I'm confused. We've got literally 20% of the population unemployed, but the stock market acts like we're coming back and everything's hunky-dory. Help us understand the difference between the stock market and the economy.
Well, in the old days, and again, going back to my Stanford undergraduate, we would learn that the real economy and the financial markets were mirror images of each other. Sometimes the financial markets would get in front of the real economy and tell us things are improving or decelerating, and then the real economy would show it. Other times we would see in history, the real economy would be on one trajectory and markets wouldn't believe it, but they'd ultimately converge. So that was the theory taught at fine universities like ours. But I would say almost by design, over the course of the last 20 years, again, back to my time at the Fed and currently, the central bank in the U.S. and around the world has put a wedge between these two things, has separated the real economy from financial markets. And there's good reasons in dark days of crisis, in the darkest days of 08 and 09, why we wanted to try to bolster the one thing we could, the financial markets, so that the markets weren't imploding, leading to even worse results on the real side of the economy. But it's important that markets understood that there is that wedge between the real economy and the stock market. So if you look to the current state of affairs, we got hit, the Federal Reserve got hit by this amazing shock that they did not anticipate. And I should note that I don't believe that the Federal Reserve came into this shock very well prepared. They didn't buy enough insurance. They weren't ready for a shock. And you might well say that, well, the pandemic was not foreseeable. And maybe this pandemic wasn't foreseeable, but bad things are foreseeable. And in my framework, central banks like the Fed are in the business of trying to buy insurance off against a bunch of tail risks, really ugly things. So putting that aside, what did the Fed do when the shock hit? It threw the rather scarce ammunition it had at it. It cut interest rates to zero, took the 2008-2009 playbook that we invented more than a decade ago and threw that at it. And what financial markets said was, oh, I get this. The Federal Reserve wants risky assets to go up. And almost in a Pavlovian response to the money and support the Fed was throwing, financial markets have bid up very quickly, so much that we had what seems to be a very short bear market. And by that, I say seems to have had.
But then what happens when the Fed stops pumping dollars into the system? Doesn't the market just crash?
Well, we haven't run that experiment of stopping. If I go back to, again, 2008 and 09, we did radical things in 08 and 09 to try to mitigate the risk that things got worse. But in the decade between the end of that crisis and the beginning of this crisis, I would say we never really normalized. We never really backed down. We never really raised interest rates, and we certainly really never shrunk the Fed balance sheet that we had expanded once. So I'll just tell you one old saw that a discussion I had with a former colleague at the central bank when we were contemplating whether or not to do more of these extraordinary things after the last crisis ended. I said, so if we do more of this stuff, more quantitative easing, more aggressive central bank buying, if it works, what'll we do? And he said, well, we'll do more of it. And I said, what if we do more of this quantitative easing? We're still more aggressive and it doesn't work. what will we do? And his answer was, we'll do more of it. So I don't think we really run that counterfactual, but you raised the right question. Now, 12 years, 13 years into extraordinary Fed actions, not just in crises when I think they're called for, but in peace times, what happens if you go in the other direction? And again, we haven't really run that experiment. And if we do run that experiment, financial markets might have something to say about it. And more important in my view, Howard, what the Fed should be focused on is the real economy. We focus on the real economy and the conduct of what central bankers do, financial markets will ultimately figure it out. And because, as I mentioned, this shock hits the real economy first, I hope that my colleagues in Washington cast their gaze more in that direction than they do to the corridors of Wall Street.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with Kevin Warsh, former Federal Reserve System governor, about the impact of COVID-19 on our economy. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with former Federal Reserve System Governor Kevin Warsh about the impacts of COVID-19 on our economy. There's a lot of debate about whether the money is finding its way to the right people, or right, not wrong word, the right entities. Is it making its way to Main Street, or is it making its way to Wall Street? Do you think that the emphasis and the focus has been in the right place?
You're going to see me try to duck out that answer because I would say, listen, my colleagues at the Fed are in the middle of a war right now. And the last thing they need is some soldier from the last war to sort of tell them what to do. I guess I would just see if I could say it a bit more constructively.
Okay.
Central banks should be in the business of providing their largesse neutrally. By that is, we don't want to be giving liquidity, free money in all of its form to people that happen to be screaming the loudest or seem to be the most well-connected. We want the liquidity to find its way to Main Street, to the real economy. We want the programs that the Federal Reserve announces to be given without fear or favor. So I maybe not so subtly am suggesting that providing that liquidity to all comers, instead of saying you have to jump through these 47 hoops, and if you don't, you're not going to get the money, that is inappropriate as a matter of monetary policy, in my view. It will also lead to recriminations. We're still in the middle of this crisis, and some people are being threatened with, how dare you take money that the Congress or the Federal Reserve provided? Again, if we provide ample and immediate liquidity to all solvent businesses, we won't get in the business ex post of saying someone got an unfair benefit.
So aside from recriminations, I have to tell you, I was walking down University Avenue in Palo Alto that you remember well this weekend. And I had to go pick up something at CVS. And I said, I'm just going to walk up and down this street. And I looked at all the restaurants and all the little businesses and all the shops and the curio shops, not the chains, the little small mom and pops. And I asked myself this question, how many of these will be here in a year?
Right.
Because this crisis is not going to go away anytime soon, you know, maybe until we have a vaccine. And I'm just curious, pull out your crystal ball and help us understand, what's this all going to look like a year, 2 years from now? Who are the winners? Who are the losers? Who are we going to lose? Who are we going to keep?
So again, a lot of that depends on public policy, but you're making me break my first rule of Milton Friedman and not say we don't know. These are the most important words that are said in all professions, including economics. But unless the magic pill arrives over the course of the next 30 or 60 days that eradicates COVID-19 from the face of the earth, something which I'm told from my epidemiology friends is highly unlikely, we're going to be living with the virus, and I would say living with the consequences of the virus on business and human behavior, and also on the public policy response. So when you look at mom and pops, maybe University Avenue in Palo Alto is not indicative of the real part of the country, but I appreciate that's where you are walking, Howard.
That's my Main Street.
I understand. It's a very nice Main Street. For most Main Streets across the country, though, there isn't a quick bounce back. And you think of a dozen places that are serving coffee in a small town or in a medium-sized town across the country. most of these businesses are not highly profitable. And I think there's good reason to think that some meaningful number of them will shut down. The labor, the employees will move to other sectors and other industries. And that's a reallocation of capital that is painful, a reallocation of labor that is painful. But I would say it's necessary in order for the economy to be strong again, wage growth to be strong again, productivity to improve again. So we might say we want to go back to how things were 120 days ago. But I would say there's actually no going back. There's the only way out of this is forward. And so what we can do as a matter of public policy is cushion the blow, provide cash grants and other things to minimize the harm. This is a rich and generous country, and we have an obligation to our fellow citizens. But to try to recreate the Main Street of 120 days ago as if nothing happened strikes me as something that isn't doing favors for many people and will only extend the period of the recession. The market cap of the most successful companies are moving up, and in that it looks to me for some good reason. I don't know this specifically, but I suspect that the Amazons of the world have picked up more market share in the last 3 months than they expected to pick up in the next 3 years. And I'll use them as an example, but that's true in many sectors and subsectors. And so we're likely to end up after the coronavirus with a somewhat different market structure. So that's inside the US economy. And I'll make one other, hopefully slightly less wonky point. The countries that respond to this best, the countries whose economic policies, geopolitical policies are the strongest, the clearest, are likely to do better and get a bigger piece of the global economic pie. So it's not just competition within companies, it's really a healthy competition among countries to look out for their own citizens. And there's a huge opportunity in light of the changing geopolitical dynamics for the U.S. to put its best foot forward, to be a better ally to our allies and to be a tougher adversary to our adversaries, and come out of this so that the U.S. is in a stronger position. So as I said earlier, in what might sound almost Pollyannish, the 21st century can be ours as well.
There can be no better way to end this show than with that statement. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM. Listen to this and other episodes anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or anywhere else you get your podcasts.